this time on your weekly constitutional. Should transgender people be barred from military service? We'll speak with Eric Merriam, who up until recently taught at the United States Air Force Academy.
The generation that is currently in college just doesn't see these issues in the same way that our generation does. I'm not bothered by things in the same way some of us may be. And so I did not get from most cadets a strong sense that there was going to be a big problem in allowing transgender people to serve in the military, just like there hadn't been a problem in allowing people of homosexual sexual orientation to serve in the military.
I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly constitutional, and this week it's about the military and service by transgender people.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
Eric Merriam is an associate professor of legal studies and political science at the University of Central Florida. Recently, he published a paper in the Dickinson Law Review with an interesting title, Fire, Aim, Ready, Militarizing Animus, Unit Cohesion, and the Transgender Ban. Well, when you see a title like that, you got to have the guy on the show.
Hi, well, thanks so much for having me. My name is Eric Merriam. I'm an associate professor at the University of Central Florida, where I teach in both the legal studies and political science departments. My areas of scholarship are constitutional law and national security law.
And how do we know each other? It seems we have a friend in common.
I don't know if we want to call him a friend or not, but yes, I'm a former colleague of Professor Doug McKechnie, who I believe is the First Amendment guru for your program.
We call him the First Amendment guy. Yeah, he's been on many times.
He and I were both professors together at the Air Force Academy years ago.
And every time I'm reminded of that, still is an element of surprise for me that the Air Force Academy has law professors at it. But as I always tell Doug, I'm glad they do, because when you're giving we're going to give the Air Force officers nuclear weapons and airplanes to deliver them with and missiles and other things. And I really want them to know about the law and how they are subject to civilian control. And that's a very important constitutional concept.
And it's one of the concepts that we get into at the Air Force Academy, or I did when I was there, in the mandatory course. In fact, you can major in law at both the Air Force Academy and at the Military Academy at West Point. But also, every single cadet has to take a semester-long 3-credit law class. And one of those principal topics of discussion is, of course, civilian control of the military.
I am so grateful for that. So well done both to you and to Doug. And it was Doug, in fact, who alerted me to your new article with a really compelling title. What is it?
Fire, Aim, Ready.
Fire, Aim, Ready.
And in that order. And the subtitle is Militarizing Animus, Unit Cohesion, and the Transgender Ban, referring, of course, to the Trump administration's ban on service by transgender persons announced by Twitter in the summer of 2017.
Well, I know that word animus, but why don't you tell us where it comes from?
So animus is the concept in the area of constitutional law we call equal protection. Of course, the Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment says that no state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. And we know that the federal government is not a state, but the Supreme Court, in a series of cases beginning in Bowling versus Sharp way back in 1954, said that the principles of equal protection apply also to the federal government through the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment. So that's perhaps a little bit more technical than we need to be, but the concept of animus is a fairly new concept in equal protection. If I can just
before we leave Bowling versus Sharp, before we do Bowling versus Sharp, you mentioned that, and you mentioned that so-called reverse incorporation, and we do have a lot of constitutional nerds who listen. So let's take a moment. The Equal Protection Clause begins with the words "No state shall." So if you want a straight textual or even a historical analysis, it was aimed squarely at the states, because it was some states, at least, that were systematically denying protection to African Americans through the institution of slavery and later Jim Crow. On the other hand, what law, what part of the Constitution says that that still applies to the United States government, the national government? And the story I always heard, and I can't verify this, but was it Earl Warren was in the final stages of issuing this opinion and simply made the statement that it was a federal district, right? It was D.C. versus Bowling, wasn't it?
That's right.
Right. And so how can you apply the Equal Protection Clause? And the story goes, he basically said, we'll just go backward through the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment and say that that makes it applicable to the feds. Is that the way it happened?
That's my understanding as well. That is actually my understanding. Of course, Bowling versus Sharp was a companion case to Brown versus Board,
right,
which was going to rely solely on equal protection to announce that the school public school segregation was unconstitutional in violation of the Equal Protection Clause. And basically, they needed to come to the same conclusion in the case involving D.C. public schools. And that was the way Chief Justice Warren figured out to do it.
And it, I think, is illustrative of his jurisprudence generally. Although he is very respected and even revered in liberal circles and equally despised in conservative circles, I don't think anyone called him a great constitutional scholar. I think he was very results-oriented and guided by his own sense of justice and injustice more than he was by constitutional doctrine.
And was able to rule with a strong fist. There's significant indication that Brown versus Board was not originally headed towards being a unanimous opinion. And other times throughout Chief Justice Warren's chiefdom, that was apparently the case. And he kind of browbeat some other justices into issuing a unanimous opinion.
The only other Chief Justice I can think of who had similar sway over his colleagues was John Marshall, often considered the most important Chief Justice in our history. But Earl Warren was a strong leader as well, and a very important one, whether you like his policies and his rulings or not. But anyway, I couldn't let that one pass without sharing that anecdote. But okay, pick up from there. So the concept of animus and equal protection goes back to the 50s.
Well, the concept of equal protection applying to the federal government does.
Uh-huh.
The concept of animus is actually somewhat newer, and we really see the idea of animus first arising in the early 1970s. In the Department of Agriculture versus Moreno case that many of us law nerds are quite familiar with. Mm-hmm. And in that case, the Supreme Court was evaluating a constitutional challenge to the Food Stamp Act, which disqualified households with two or more unrelated individuals living in the same house, two or more unrelated adults living in the same house, from receiving food stamp benefits. So it was aimed at ostensibly reducing fraud. But along the way to passing the Food Stamp Act, a couple legislators on the floor while discussing the bill referred to hippies and hippie communes. And the Supreme Court saw that legislative history and basically decided that the real purpose behind the Food Stamp Act was actually a, quote, congressional desire to harm a politically unpopular group, close quote. And what the court said in Moreno is that if, and I'm quoting now, if the constitutional conception of equal protection of the laws means anything, it must at the very least mean that a bare desire to harm a politically unpopular group cannot constitute a legitimate government interest. And the Supreme Court struck down that Food Stamp Act because of the use of the word hippie in the floor debate about the bill. And that's where that's kind of the birth of this concept of animus. So just take one step back, what we call traditional equal protection jurisprudence has usually, and you mentioned already that the kind of equal protection clause arrives in the Constitution in the form of the 14th Amendment, which is ratified in 1868, immediately after the conclusion of the Civil War. It arrives initially, at least, to ensure the equal protection of the laws for African Americans. The way equal protection developed over the years was a focus on government classification. So if the government is treating different groups of people differently, the Supreme Court's going to look at that, or the judiciary, and really over time, despite what the language of the text of the 14th Amendment sounds like, which is a flat prohibition on treating different groups of people differently, we get the reverse, which is that the Supreme Court in essence says, so long as the government is acting rationally to accomplish a legitimate interest, it's okay to treat different groups of people differently. And so we can think of the classic examples of my 11-year-old is not allowed to drive a car, and that's a good thing. But she is certainly being treated differently than people who are of age who are permitted to drive a car. What we see in the traditional equal protection jurisprudence is a focus on classification and whether or not that classification is quote unquote suspect or not. The most suspicious, if you will, type basis of classification is race. So classifications based on race are suspect, and the court applies strict scrutiny to those kind of classifications.
if the government is making a run-of-the-mill distinction between people over 16 and people under 16 for driver's licenses, or whether it refuses to give a driver's license, for example, to a blind person, or, you know, makes a different taxes different people or different business entities at different rates, those are all run-of-the-mill distinctions between groups of people, but they're typically allowed, as you say, as long as there's a reasonable purpose and there's a legitimate purpose and a rational relationship to the government's goal. And that's a very low bar. That means most of those distinctions are going to be allowed, despite someone making a claim that it violates equal protection. But certain groups of people have been historically discriminated against based on something typically called an immutable or unchangeable characteristic. And so, as you say, the classic example is race. And indeed, historically, it's very clear that that's what the 14th Amendment was about to begin with. And so if the government differentiates people on the basis of race, however we define that these days, then the government's going to have to pass a very high bar, and it's going to have to show. It has the burden of showing two things. First, that it has not just a legitimate purpose, but a compelling purpose, and that secondly, what it's doing is the least restrictive way of achieving that purpose. And it's often been said that strict scrutiny is strict in theory, but fatal in practice, that the government almost always loses.
Right. And that seems to be the case as it relates to race. The Supreme Court has only ever found two compelling interests that permit the government to discriminate based on race, and those are to remedy prior instances of discrimination by law.
Affirmative action.
Mm-hmm. Or the affirmative action that takes place in the context of education, which is to achieve diversity in the context of higher education. Those are the only two instances in which the Supreme Court has said, yes, it is okay, government, for you to discriminate based on race.
And so we have, and by the way, those rulings are very much in doubt, and their longevity is with the current court. But that's how narrowly they've been interpreted in the past. I mean, those are the only exceptions. Okay, please go on.
Right. Okay, and so that's how the initial, as we've said a couple times now, the focus of the Equal Protection Clause initially on race. That's what the Supreme Court initially focuses on in terms of these suspect classifications. In the 1970s, the Supreme Court added sex-based classifications as what it sometimes refers to as quasi-suspect classification. And what that means is that when the government's discriminating based on sex, sometimes referred to as gender, that the government has to meet intermediate scrutiny. So the test is somewhat different, and that test is that the government has to be trying to accomplish an important, rather than compelling, important government interest, and that the classification, in other words, the discrimination based on sex, has to be substantially related to accomplishing that important government interest. So what the Supreme Court has essentially set up is a three-tier system. The top tier, the top level of classification and the strictest scrutiny the courts are going to apply applies to race discrimination or race classifications. Sex classifications are intermediate, and the reason they are somewhat less than race, even though initially the Supreme Court considered applying strict scrutiny to sex-based discriminations as well and articulated in a plurality opinion that it would in Frontiero versus Richardson before backing off of that and establishing intermediate scrutiny in Craig versus Boren a few years later. The reason is that unlike race, where it's very difficult to imagine any legitimate or non-invidious reason why you might want to distinguish among people based on race, Supreme Court has recognized, okay, there are some differences between the sexes that might, in some occasions, justify discriminating based on sex.
But as you point out, that was a 1970s era decision, and it was controversial at the time that the gender-based discrimination was not given strict scrutiny. As my good friend and feminist and voting rights expert or suffrage, women's suffrage expert Wanda Sobieski insists, it's women just get sort of half constitutional protection. And so even to this day, people question that. And I wonder if ultimately the court may actually elevate gender discrimination to strict scrutiny, because as time goes on, there are fewer and fewer seeming justifications for treating women differently. The standard one used to be military service, but I think we've changed that perception.
Right, absolutely.
And so that might be also endangered in the future, and women might get Wanda may finally get her full, complete constitutional equality. So.
And back, that's right. Back when, and not only half equality, but or half the rights, but also women seem to get them later. Right. So we see the
that's what my wife always tells me that. Yeah.
So in the 70s, in fact, then Attorney Ginsburg, now, of course, Justice Ginsburg, argued for strict scrutiny when she argued cases before the court, suggesting that sex should be treated like race in terms of being suspicious of the government classifying in that way. And one of the theories, in fact, beyond a theory, one of the cases, several justices were anticipating that the Equal Rights Amendment, which was at the time going through the ratification process, was going to get ratified, and that they didn't really need to establish strict scrutiny for discrimination based on sex because the Equal Rights Amendment was going to accomplish that shortly anyway. So let's let the people do it through the amendment process. Of course, we know that that never happened.
It's a Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about banning transgender people from the military. Stick around. You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is Eric Merriam, who used to teach at the United States Air Force Academy and has recently written a law review article about the transgender ban in the military. Just before the break, we were talking about the Equal Protection Clause and how it never really protected women to the same degree as it did minorities, racial minorities. And part of that reason was because people thought back in the 70s that we were going to get the Equal Rights Amendment for women, which, of course, hasn't happened so far. Though I have to interject, we just recently did a show on the continuing attempts to get the necessary states to ratify that. So that issue is lurking out there as well. But please continue.
All right. So in the 70s, we both get this new tier of classification and this the birth of this idea in Moreno that it's not okay for the government to discriminate when its purpose for discrimination is dislike. That's animus. It's this notion that dislike of a disfavored group is an insufficient basis for distinguishing between that group and others in terms of treatment under the law. So that's the beginning. Moreno starts this concept of animus. Another case that's it's important, it's not always talked about in the in discussions of animus because it doesn't use the word animus, but there was a case in the early 80s called Palmore versus Sadati. That one actually comes out of Florida where I am now. And in that case, a family court judge had awarded sole custody of a child to the child's father because the child's mother was in an interracial marriage, and the court, the trial court, the family court, was worried that the child of an interracial marriage would be subjected to disdain in the community. Again, this is the early 80s, so this idea that, you know, your mom is one race and your dad is another race in this interracial marriage, that's going to be bad for the child. And of course, applying the best interest of the child standard, as family court judges are supposed to do in deciding custody, the trial judge awarded custody to the father who is not in an interracial marriage. Well, the Supreme Court said that violated the Equal Protection Clause too. Why? Quote, private biases may be outside the reach of the law, but the law cannot directly or indirectly give them effect. Close quote. So the idea here is the law cannot codify or cement private biases. We can't just import people's private stereotype, people's private biases, and call it law.
Let's pause there, Eric, because I've always found that a fascinating case. Because I'll have to genuinely admit, I think there were arguments on both sides. I mean, as you say, the standard is the best interest of the child. And if all the judge was doing was trying to look at the situation and all of its factors and say, where is this child going to be happiest? Where is this child going to have the least troublesome childhood? I recognize racism in society exists and the mother is in an interracial relationship. And I just think this kid is going to get rocks thrown at him. I think this kid is going to get teased on the playground and won't have as many friends as he otherwise would have. So if you purely look only for what's right for this particular child in this particular situation, I think the judge had a point. But the court said ultimately that even if that's true, and even though the best interests of the child are paramount in custody cases, effectively what the government through the court system would be doing was in some sense ratifying the racism of the community in which this child was going to live if he lived with his mother and her African-American partner. So that was a very important point, and that I think it represents an even greater recognition that animus is not to be allowed, however it creeps into the courtroom.
That's right. And even if the government actor, as you just mentioned, is the judicial branch, right? Mm-hmm. In this instance, this isn't the, you know, the legislature or the governor imposing some private bias for the for political gain or something. This is the judiciary, and again, not saying necessarily that the judge himself or herself was racist, but was just recognizing the existence of racism and racial prejudice in the community, and trying to divine what the best interest of the child was given the existence of that. And the court says no. We are not going to, as you say, ratify private prejudice or private bias. So that's an important case that relates to the, and they do that based on the Equal Protection Clause. And that's an important case in this, the development of what I call the animus doctrine. The next big case comes 1 year later. It's the one that most people learn in law school as being kind of the genesis of the animus concept of equal protection, and that's Cleburne versus Cleburne Living Center. Mm-hmm. Just very quickly, that's the case in which the Supreme Court held that the Cleburne City Council, Cleburne, Texas, violated the Equal Protection Clause by denying a permit to the Cleburne Living Center, which was a group home for mentally disabled persons. And what the Supreme Court determined was that the reason the Cleburne City Council denied the permit was because of the objections of community members. Why? Because they didn't want mentally disabled people in their neighborhood.
Yeah.
That calling on the notion from Palmore that we're not going to allow private biases to be given effect by the law. In Cleburne, the Supreme Court said that it was an irrational prejudice against the mentally disabled, and that the court determined it's immaterial whether the irrational prejudice belonged to the city council members or if they were just accomplishing what their constituents wanted. In other words, they were just acquiescing to the city residents' stereotypes and prejudices and fears of the intellectually disabled. In any event, the court says, you can't do that. It's important because the plaintiffs in that case actually argued for a classification-based analysis, which is classifications based on mental disability ought to get some form of heightened scrutiny too, just like race and sex that we've already talked about. And the Supreme Court said, no, we're not going to apply some level of heightened scrutiny to classifications based on mental disability. And yet the court still struck down the law, the permitting decision by the city council, because of this concept of animus.
You know, I've always felt that made it a much stronger opinion. And it paved the way for some several cases I know you're about to discuss. But I thought it made it a much stronger opinion because, I mean, isn't it the ultimate condemnation by a court by looking litigants in the eye and saying, you're just doing this because you hate these people, and that's unconstitutional? That was a very, very important decision. And by the way, whenever I discuss this case in my introductory constitutional law class, I relate the fact that although I never took a land use or planning class in law school, much of my practice in Florida, where you are now, back in the 90s, involved those issues. And those, far from being boring, are some of the most passionate cases out there. And it frequently, these sorts of fears and these sorts of prejudices are evident in the legislative record. So this is highly, highly relevant to everyday life in every town USA.
Right, because we're talking about the things that affect your backyard, right? The NIMBY nature of people's opposition. You know, it's fine to have a group home in our community so long as it's not, you know, next to my house.
Right.
And you're absolutely right. The passion that gets aroused when you start getting close to home in a literal sense is interesting and prevalent in the law. So Cleburne's an interesting marker because a number of scholars at the time thought that perhaps the court would in fact find that classifications based on mental disability would get some kind of heightened scrutiny, some kind of additional judicial look. And the Supreme Court chose not to go that direction, even though it had a case that would perfectly have allowed it to do so. Importantly, and this is where I kind of want to talk more broadly about animus doctrine in general, since that case, 1985, the Supreme Court has not created or identified a new classification that gets heightened scrutiny. So we still have race and national origin. We still have sex, and also one we haven't talked about, which is legitimacy, fairly infrequent cases.
Non-marital children, right.
Right, correct. And other than that, we have this rational basis review, which is this incredibly easy standard for the courts to meet. So since 1985, in none of the cases in which people, plaintiffs have advanced new classifications for which they believe the court should apply heightened scrutiny of some type. The court has not taken them up on that in any case. So since basically the early 80s, the Supreme Court hasn't used its quote unquote classification approach to rule that some law violated equal protection.
And although it's impossible to say exactly why that is, but I think most people probably who watch the court probably share my perception that during that time, from basically from actually the early 70s forward, the court has gotten more and more conservative. And part of that conservatism is less concern about individual rights, or certainly less concern about allowing judicial relief for them, and perhaps more deference to state and national legislatures in these areas. And that's an important thing to remember, is that the period of time you're talking about is not a return to Warren Court relatively liberal jurisprudence. It's the court in general going in the opposite direction. And I think that's what makes your argument about animus all the more compelling. So please pick up the thread there.
Sure. And the scholars who've started kind of articulating this animus doctrine, which is this notion that the court's real concern as it relates to equal protection over the last three decades has really been only in instances where it detects some kind of impermissible purpose going on, rather than focusing itself on what the classification is itself. In other words, is it a racial classification or is it a sex classification? The court seems to only be concerned in the last few decades when it smells something rotten. In other words, it discerns an impermissible dislike, an attempt to harm a particular group. And I'm kind of a little bit late to the party in terms of the animus doctrine scholarship, but several scholars over the last decade have noticed this shift away from classification-based approach and have suggested that really animus is the primary, I hate to use the pun here, animating principle of equal protection doctrine today. In addition to your observation that the court is more conservative and perhaps less likely to identify new classifications, and that certainly goes back to the 70s. Mm-hmm. As soon as it switches from the Warren Court to the Berger Court, we start seeing new classifications, and sex is an outlier, but we start seeing new classifications being advanced as meriting heightened scrutiny and the court striking them down. So age gets rational basis review rather than heightened scrutiny. Wealth-based classifications meet the same fate. The court there, again, the Berger Court says, no, wealth-based classifications are just going to get rational basis review as well. So picking up with animus, Cleburne sets the stage for the idea that the attempt to harm a particular group of people is unconstitutional because it violates equal protection. The next case we see after Cleburne comes a decade later in Romer versus Evans, and that, of course, is the case in which Colorado passed a state constitutional amendment, which essentially removed sexual orientation from the list of protected classes. So what does that mean? So if the city of Boulder, Colorado, has a law that says we do not discriminate based on, you fill in the blank, age, national origin, sex, veteran status, and if sexual orientation was on the list, as it was in Boulder, Colorado at the time, that got removed by the amendment. In other words, Colorado Amendment 2 disallowed governments from specially protecting sexual orientation as a class, or people who have minority sexual orientations, if you will. So the Supreme Court in Romer versus Evans, this is Justice Kennedy now writing, applies the same principle and says this amendment 2 imposes a broad and undifferentiated disability on one group of people, and only one group of people, that is homosexual people. And he says this law is both too narrow and too broad at the same time, and is thus inexplicable by anything but animus toward the class that it affects. In other words, as I was just suggesting, Justice Kennedy does not say, well, classifications based on sexual orientation should get heightened scrutiny. What he does say is when it's animus that seems to be the reason, the motivating factor behind the government discrimination with government classification, that's unconstitutional. And this has been referred to both starting with Cleburne and going forward as an additional tier of scrutiny, something some people call rational basis plus or rational basis with bite. But the kind of animus doctrine scholars are saying, well, it's not really a different classification. What it really is just saying there's another basis for striking down a law as being unconstitutional because it violates the Equal Protection Clause.
Let's talk a little bit about Romer versus Evans. I think this is probably the single most important individual rights case that is least known by the public. In fact, even in the area of gay rights, people always go and talk about Lawrence versus Texas, which essentially declared so-called sodomy statutes unconstitutional. That one gets all of the press, and that's, people, I think, perhaps focus upon some imagined salacious details from the case. But Romer versus Evans was the one where Justice Kennedy, a guy who considered himself and for the most part was a fairly conservative guy, was so appalled by what he saw in the state of Colorado. And it bears repeating, not only did this constitutional amendment, this was a direct exercise of popular democracy in a sovereign state within our union, the people of Colorado essentially undid all protections for sexual orientation in Colorado and then prevented people, even in localities, from reenacting those things. And so essentially said, people who are in favor of gay rights in Colorado cannot effectively change the law, even in their localities, without first amending the constitution of the state. And in one respect, this was such a total victory for those people who were opposed to gay rights. It was basically stomping gay rights into the soil of Colorado that Justice Kennedy and the majority said, this is appalling, and the only reason we can think you're doing this to these people is because you hate them, and that's unconstitutional. I think that has to be one of the most strong denunciations of hatred and bigotry in all of the Supreme Court canon.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think the reason, perhaps, this is my own theory, so why it hasn't gotten quite as much discussion as, for example, you talk about Windsor, is that the reason or the explanation by Justice Kennedy for why this was unconstitutional, why it violated equal protection, is somewhat technical in that it was not based on a classification. It was not based on, it's not fair to treat these a particular group of people differently in the direct sense, such as in Lawrence versus Texas, where homosexual persons were not allowed to engage in sodomy while heterosexual persons were, which seems quite unfair. Here it's a law. It's kind of a legal structure that is engaging in discrimination. This notion, as you mentioned, that unlike every other group in Colorado, including people with blue eyes or people who like to hike or any classification or group you can imagine, homosexual people were prevented from securing from their local governments or from state government protection against classification, and only homosexual persons were prevented from doing so. And so it's the law, the kind of the technical element, I think, of why Amendment 2 was so pernicious that maybe causes us not to talk about Romer as much, but I couldn't agree more. Romer is a huge development, and particularly for this concept of animus, which is that is the basis for the opinion in Romer versus Evans.
Which is why I always tell my students that if you believe in gay rights, go out to the store, get yourself a portrait of Justice Kennedy, frame it and put it on your wall, because I think he has to be among the greatest champions of gay rights in the history of the court, maybe the greatest. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week I'm speaking with Eric Merriam, who's a professor at the University of Central Florida and who's written a law review article recently about the transgender ban in the military. Stick around. And now it's time to finish our discussion with Eric Merriam of the University of Central Florida, formerly of the United States Air Force Academy, who's written an article recently about the transgender ban in the military. Before the break, we were talking about Justice Anthony Kennedy, who is probably the greatest champion of gay rights in the history of the United States Supreme Court.
No doubt about it. And he writes the four key gay rights opinions. He writes the majority opinion in all four of them. So Romer's, of course, the first one. Lawrence, you just mentioned, is the second one. There's an element of of concern about animus in Lawrence, but Lawrence is really more about due process, substantive due process, than it is about equal protection. Justice O'Connor, for example, in a concurrence in Lawrence versus Texas in 2003, said that she thought it should have been just decided based on equal protection principles alone. In other words, you're treating homosexual people who want to engage in sodomy different than heterosexual people who want to engage in sodomy, and that's inappropriate. She thought that equal protection by itself was sufficient. Kennedy disagreed and thought that substantive due process was an important element of why the law in Texas that banned homosexual sodomy only was a constitutional violation of the of liberty.
You mentioned substantive due process, and that's another one of those very sticky doctrines, and we don't have time to go into it here. But essentially what the court was saying, although it never said it explicitly, and there are people who are still disagree with this interpretation, was that you and I and everybody else in this country has a fundamental individual right, even though it may not be mentioned specifically in the Constitution, to engage in consensual adult sexual activity without government interference. It's a different way of looking at the same situation. Equal protection analysis probably would have centered on your animus theory, but there are many, many cases where both, either or both of those theories are used in combination.
That's right. And there's and there's good reason for that. Obergefell, the kind of the latest and perhaps most profound opinion that Justice Kennedy wrote in terms of advancing gay rights, of course, the same-sex marriage case. In Obergefell, he uses and intertwines substantive due process and equal protection quite a bit to the derision of the dissenters and some scholars and to the delight of others. But in any event, the notion that equal protection and due process are intertwined is absolutely correct. One of the interesting things about Lawrence and one of the explanations for why Justice Kennedy didn't rely solely on equal protection, as Justice O'Connor suggested that the majority should have, is this notion of positive versus negative rights. And we'll go into it for too much here, but traditionally, negative rights, which means the right to be free from government interference, have been distinguished from positive rights, which means the right to something from the government. And usually the Equal Protection Clause has been used to protect positive rights, that right to something from the government, while the Due Process Clause, this notion of substantive due process, has been used to protect negative rights, meaning the right to be free from government interference. And the concern that some people have suggested was really underlying Justice Kennedy's opinion is, if it had been only based on equal protection, Texas's response could have been, okay, then sodomy is illegal for everyone. And that would not have violated equal protection. And yet it still would have left homosexual people without the right to engage without being worried about criminal sanction in consensual sexual activity. And so that it's this notion of leveling up, if you will, rather than allowing states to level down, that some people have offered as an explanation for why due process is perhaps a better way to vindicate some rights than equal protection alone.
It's a very interesting thing, and this is public radio, so we're not going to go into detail, but I'll simply say that so-called sodomy statutes, some of which are very explicit in what they're outlawing, and some of which are ridiculously vague, involve activities that probably heterosexuals have done to virtually the same degree as homosexuals have done. I mean, there are only so many things a human body can do, and a lot of people do them. And so the sort of statute that was struck down in Texas was aimed at homosexual sodomy. But if it had been made into one that was more broad, how many, I will sometimes say, and I don't want a show of hands, but how many people in this room would be instant felons? People do these things. And that, I think, is the essential point that was made, is that maybe the government has no business regulating those sorts of intimate activities.
Right. And in fact, Justice O'Connor, very delicately, and I don't remember the quote exactly off the top of my head, made the point you just made in her concurrence in Lawrence, and basically said, I'm not too worried about whether Texas just decides to impose criminal liability on everyone for engaging in sodomy. In fact, such a law would not long stand in our democratic society, kind of delicately suggesting that if everybody was prohibited from engaging in sodomy, that law would go away.
Could very well. Okay, on to the next case.
On to the next case. So we're soon arriving to present day. And I don't want to get into too much detail. In United States versus Windsor, there are a lot of different elements of that case. That's the case in which the Supreme Court, again, Justice Kennedy writing from the majority, struck down the Defense of Marriage Act. For our purposes here in relation to animus, the key part of that decision is that Justice Kennedy found that the quote-unquote purpose and effect of the Defense of Marriage Act was to, quote, disparage and injure those whom the state, by its marriage laws, sought to protect in personhood and dignity, close quote. And so what he's saying essentially is there are some states out there who've decided that people should be allowed to marry someone of the same sex. And here comes the federal government deciding that it doesn't like same-sex marriage and people who engage in same-sex marriage. And through the Defense of Marriage Act, it is taking away the dignity of those people who some states have said do have the right to marry someone of the same sex. So once again, we see animus as a key part of the equal protection aspect of the Windsor case, in which the Defense of Marriage Act gets struck down. Again, this notion is that the court is unwilling to allow discrimination or classifications, if you will, when the group that's being harmed is being harmed not because of some incidental thing, but rather it being harmed because of dislike by the government.
Right.
So that's the central concept of animus, and that's kind of where we arrive today with my argument in the
article. Well, wait a minute, just to put them in order. Obergefell is the big one. That's the one but it built upon all the previous ones. And that's the one, of course, that said that states cannot deny same-sex marriages.
That's right. And so Obergefell, very important, and we can talk about it if you like, not central to the concept of animus per se, because really Justice Kennedy kind of makes it fairly clear. He thinks that he's establishing or reestablishing, relying somewhat on Lawrence, the notion of due process as the basis for the right to engage, for the right to marry, and that right to marry includes the right to marry someone of the same sex. Obergefell is somewhat confusing. I've spent many hours trying to kind of figure out the relationship between due process and equal protection in Obergefell. What he does say that can relate to the animus concept is that basically laws that prohibit the states that were prohibiting same-sex marriage, the effect of that was to demean or disparage the groups who were not, the people who were not permitted to marry. He doesn't use the word animus.
But all but.
Yeah. It seems to be primarily concerned with the notion that that if the effect of a selective exclusion from something that's important, in this instance, something that's fundamental, the right to marry, the Supreme Court's said that is a fundamental right in a number of cases. If the effect of selectively excluding someone is to harm them or to demean them or to disparage them, then that is also unconstitutional. What separates Obergefell a little bit from the traditional animus concept is that Kennedy did not say in Obergefell that the purpose of government in banning same-sex marriage was to disparage or to harm. The effect may
certainly,
have been,
certainly
but he
effect.
Did not go so far as to say that's what you're trying to do. In other words, normal traditional animus doctrine is premised on the idea that government is trying to harm, intentionally trying to harm a particular group. And what he said in Obergefell was, well, that's the effect of what's going on.
Right.
You're subordinating another group.
Well, we're getting low on time here, Eric, and I definitely want to get to your argument. So the next frontier that we've been hearing a lot about lately is transgender people. And you're concerned about their ban from the military and how it's relevant to animus doctrine. So please.
Absolutely. So I mentioned that in the summer of 2017, President Trump announced by three tweets, that transgender individuals were not going to be permitted to serve in the military. And if you would permit me, I'll read the tweets to you. They're quick. After consultation with my generals and military experts, please be advised that the United States government will not accept or allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military. Our military must be focused on decisive and overwhelming victory and cannot be burdened with the tremendous medical costs and disruption that transgender in the military would entail. So that's the ban initially. A month later, we actually get something more than a couple of tweets, a presidential memorandum from the White House to the Secretaries of Defense and Homeland Security, ordering them to prepare policies that would essentially revert to the way the law had been a few years earlier, before the Obama administration allowed transgender persons to serve in the military, and basically said, we're going to go back to the way it was. You've got 6 months to come up with a policy to accomplish that. And sure enough, in February of 2018, then Secretary of Defense Mattis issued a report and basically came up with recommendations. The idea was that that transgender persons would be disqualified from military service. There are some very small exceptions. So people who had already been serving and who were transgender and who were diagnosed with what's called gender dysphoria, which is the basic idea that the distinction between one's biologically assigned sex and one's gender identity causes difficulty for those people. So it's a kind of a mental health concern, frankly. Basically, discomfort with your biological sex results in significant distress or difficulty functioning. Mm-hmm. Those people would be allowed to serve, to continue serving, so long as they received a diagnosis of gender dysphoria before the effective date of the ban. So in essence, transgender members or persons who wanted to serve in the military couldn't have had dysphoria within the prior 36 months if they wanted to join. If they were already in, they had to be willing to serve, quote unquote, in their biological sex, meaning wearing the uniforms of their biological sex rather than their gender identity, meeting the physical fitness standards of their biological sex rather than their gender identity, et cetera. The effect of the recommendations by Secretary of Defense Mattis was that virtually all transgender people, though I cannot say all, there are some pre-existing people serving who do meet the exception that they're allowed to stay in the military, but nearly all transgender people are excluded from military service. The argument that I made in the article was that one of the primary justifications that the government offered, the Trump administration offered, for excluding transgender persons from military service was unit cohesion. And unit cohesion is this idea in the military, one that has been studied quite a bit and one that is certainly significant. But the idea is that disruption in a unit, disrupting the cohesion, the kind of morale, the ability to get along, the ability to work together to accomplish a mission, that unit cohesion is central to winning wars, to accomplishing the mission of military units, and that the presence of transgender people might disrupt unit cohesion. And what I argue is that is per se, meaning by itself, animus. And the reason for that is it is doing what the court said in Palmore versus Sadati we may not do, which is the government can't give effect to private bias and prejudice. What is the government doing when it says you can't serve in the military because your presence in the military might bother some other people who are in the military to the degree that they're not going to be able to do their job effectively? That is the government ratifying or importing private bias, prejudice, stereotype into government action and leading to the exclusion of a particular group of people from something they would otherwise be permitted to do. So that the purpose of that article is to demonstrate that unit cohesion, which by the way, has been used as an argument for centuries by the United States military to exclude people. It was used to exclude people of color from military service. Of course, Black Americans were not allowed to serve in the United States Marine Corps until World War II. And George Washington initially said Black people could not serve in the United States military. Unit cohesion has been offered as a basis for excluding groups of people, undesired groups of people, whether people of color, then it was women, then it was homosexual people under various policies excluding homosexual persons from military service that ultimately culminated in Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And ultimately now, today, kind of the exclusion du jour is once again using unit cohesion to say, well, we can't have transgender people in the military because if we do, we won't be able to accomplish our mission.
Well, you're right, Eric. I saw those arguments or heard those arguments back in the 80s when we were struggling to integrate women into the military. And yet we didn't live together. They were in a separate barracks, but we trained together. And for the most part, it worked out pretty well. And eventually people adjusted to it. You've been talking.
And what's interesting is that the the Department of Defense had just, within the prior decade, gone through the process of telling Congress that, yes, we could allow homosexual people to serve in the military, and that we'd be able to do that without a disruption to the military effectiveness, and had, in fact, done so. And then what precipitated the Obama administration changing the policy and allowing, in 2016, transgender people to serve in the military was a significant study, an outside study, and multiple internal studies, which also said, yes, this will involve some, you know, some transition, but people will adapt and overcome. That's what the military has always done. And so it's interesting because the military's own evidence flies in the face of the Trump administration's suggestion that unicohesion is a basis for excluding people who are transgender.
Evidence? Facts? I didn't know those were relevant anymore.
I'm almost still stuck a few years ago.
We're almost done, Eric. But one last question. You, up till recently, were teaching young officer candidates at the U.S. Air Force Academy. How do they feel about this issue? Did you discuss it with them? Are they accepting of transgendered people?
I absolutely did discuss it with them. I think the overwhelming... First of all, you might be surprised to know that some of the generation that is currently in college just doesn't see these issues in the same way that our generation does, not bothered by things in the same way we some of us may be. And so I did not get from most cadets a strong sense that there was going to be a big problem in allowing transgender people to serve in the military, just like there hadn't been a problem in allowing people of homosexual sexual orientation to serve in the military. Not everybody likes it, of course. Some people have personal objections to it. But from a professional military officership standard, I did not, just speaking anecdotally about my interactions with cadets, did not get a strong objection. There are, of course, just as there were with repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, practical questions like, okay, what does this person have to do to meet their physical fitness standards? Right. Or where do they sleep? Or what kind of accommodations do we need to make for showering?
But you know what? The military always figures that out in the end. We're just about out of time.
Absolutely
does. What again is the title of your article, and where can people get it?
So the article is in the Penn State Dickinson Law Review. It was published last year, and the title of the article is Fire, Aim, Ready, and that's a nod towards the kind of backwards you just alluded to, the notion that facts and evidence and argument came after the ban rather than in front of it. Fire, Aim, Ready, Militarizing Animus, Unit Cohesion, and the Transgender Ban.
Well, Eric Merriam of the University of Central Florida, thank you for sharing that with us today.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate appearing on your show and the opportunity to talk about this important subject.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Eric Merriam of the University of Central Florida, formerly of the U.S. Air Force Academy, for his very enlightening discussion about the transgender ban in our military. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephant. Check him out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment, even if you are transgender.